London calling. David here. This one's an encore, a little top-up to yesterday's podcast about Mark Sykes, the Englishman who drew the lines on the map that gave us, gave the world, Syria and Iraq and much of the modern Middle East. Us is probably the right word, actually, if it refers to Mark Sykes and his milieu. Because that was the main point I was chipping away at in yesterday's podcast. It was the statue that was inside the block of stone, so to speak. Namely, the astonishing sense of entitlement of those people and their world. It's still with us, of course, in a hopelessly, haplessly degraded form. A century and change later, it's an albatross around the neck of this country. Bit of autobiography here. I've even had a 4-second burst of direct personal experience of this nonsense with, of all people, Boris Johnson. This was a few years ago, before he was Prime Minister. He was on his bicycle, stopped at a traffic light in Trafalgar Square. I pulled up beside him on my motorcycle. Knew who he was, of course, but certainly wasn't going to be bothered to take any notice of him, which must have bugged him or something, because I glanced in his direction, and sure enough, I was getting it. The full treatment. The look of ineffable superiority and disdain. The arrogance. The slight sneer. I thought, I'm not taking that from this prat. I said to him, "That stuff doesn't work with me, Russell. I'm an American. Take it somewhere else." Light changed and I was off. Gave him a motorcycle air biscuit for his troubles. Russell, because the word Johnson is, of course, slang for penis, and another bit of street slang for same is Russell the One-Eyed Muscle. Anyway. Now, before I get any further, a quick correction to yesterday's podcast. I said, living at 9 Buckingham Gate, Mark Sykes had for a neighbor, directly across the way, King Edward VII. That was the point. If you live in a 24-room house and just over the way is the King of England, well, it just goes with the territory. An outsized sense of entitlement is par for the course. Anyway, the King of England was Mark Sykes' neighbor, but it wasn't Edward VII, it was George V. Mark Sykes moved into 9 Buckingham Gate in 1913, and the information about his other neighbors, the equerry, the peer of the realm, the colonel in the Indian Army, etc., was taken from the 1911 census return for 9 Buckingham Gate and the other houses in that street. And here's the correction, teacher's red circle, exclamation point, and the word no in capital letters. Edward VII died in May 1910. George V was on the throne in 1913. He was the His Majesty, who was Mark Sykes' neighbor. Another tasty morsel of biographical information. Number 9 Buckingham Gate was not Mark Sykes' first choice as a London base for his parliamentary work. He was a fairly new MP. He'd won a seat in 1911. His preferred choice of a London base was a furnished house in Mayfair. But his wife put her foot down at the expense. The Mayfair house was £1,200 a year. Number 9 Buckingham Gate was much cheaper, just £500 a year. Sykes, of course, wasn't short of a bob or two, as the saying goes. In 1913, he'd inherited his father's estate, valued at nearly £300,000. £300,000 in 1913 would be in the neighborhood of £8 million today. So that Mayfair house would have set him back about £140,000 a year. 9 Buckingham Gate, a mere £58,000 a year. I have to say, given housing costs in London today, those two 1913 figures both seem way underpriced. by way of example, right now, today, there's a four-bedroom flat on Park Lane in Mayfair that's going for £260,000 a month. That's £8,666 a day, £361 an hour, £6 a minute, 10 pence a second. You're living in that flat in Park Lane and paying that rent and listening to this podcast, you're going to owe about £50 in rent by the time I sign off. £260,000 a month. That'd be about 25 times as expensive as the rental cost of the Mayfair house that Mark Sykes' wife, Edith, put the kibosh on. It's interesting to speculate why the 1913 prices were so much lower than they'd be today. Why is it so much more of a seller's market today, and thus those unimaginably high prices? My hunch is international money. A lot more super rich from all over the world are looking to buy in London in 2020 than was the case in 1913. And that, of course, drives prices way up. Anyway, for a coda, the best 650 words ever written about the milieu of 9 Buckingham Street, of Buckingham Palace, of the world of Mark Sykes and George V, of what it was like for them and their kind, their zeitgeist, the seedbed and the greenhouse of that sense of entitlement. These 650 words were written by Barbara Tuchman just over 60 years ago. They are the words that open her magisterial The Guns of August. Feast your ears on this, ladies and gentlemen. So gorgeous was the spectacle on the May morning of 1910, when 9 kings rode in the funeral of Edward VII of England, that the crowd, waiting in hushed and black-clad awe, could not keep back gasps of admiration. In scarlet and blue and green and purple, 3 by 3, the sovereigns rode through the palace gates, with plumed helmets, gold braid, crimson sashes, and jeweled orders flashing in the sun. After them came 5 heirs apparent, 40 more imperial or royal highnesses, 7 queens, 4 dowager and 3 regnant, and a scattering of special ambassadors from uncrowned countries. Together they represented 70 nations in the greatest assemblage of royalty and rank ever gathered in one place, and of its kind the last. The muffled tongue of Big Ben told 9 by the clock as the cortege left the palace. But on history's clock, it was sunset, and the sun of the old world was setting in a dying blaze of splendor, never to be seen again. In the center of the front row rode the new king, George V, flanked on his left by the Duke of Connaught, the late king's only surviving brother, and on his right, by a personage to whom, acknowledged the times, belongs the first place among all the foreign mourners, who, even when relations are most strained, has never lost his popularity amongst us, William II, the German Emperor. Mounted on a gray horse, wearing the scarlet uniform of a British field marshal, carrying the baton of that rank, the Kaiser had composed his features behind the famous upturned mustache in an expression grave even to severity. Of the several emotions churning his susceptible breast, some hints exist in his letters. I am proud to call this place my home and to be a member of this royal family, he wrote home after spending the night in Windsor Castle, in the former apartments of his mother. Sentiment and nostalgia induced by these melancholy occasions with his English relatives jostled with pride in his supremacy among the assembled potentates, and with a fierce relish in the disappearance of his uncle from the European scene. He had come to bury Edward his bane, Edward the arch-plotter, as William conceived it, of Germany's encirclement. Edward his mother's brother, whom he could neither bully nor impress, whose fat figure cast a shadow between Germany and the sun. He is Satan! You cannot imagine what a Satan he is! This verdict, announced by the Kaiser before a dinner of 300 guests in Berlin in 1907, was occasioned by one of Edward's continental tours undertaken with clearly diabolical designs at encirclement. He had spent a provocative week in Paris, visited for no good reason the King of Spain, who had just married his niece, and finished with a visit to the King of Italy, with obvious intent to seduce him from his triple alliance with Germany and Austria. The Kaiser, possessor of the least inhibited tongue in Europe, had worked himself into a frenzy, ending in another of those comments that had periodically, over the past 20 years of his reign, shattered the nerves of diplomats. Happily, the encircler was now dead and replaced by George, who the Kaiser told Theodore Roosevelt a few days before the funeral was a very nice boy of 45, 6 years younger than the Kaiser. He is a thorough Englishman and hates all foreigners, but I do not mind that as long as he does not hate Germans more than other foreigners. Alongside George, William now rode confidently, saluting as he passed the regimental colors of the 1st Royal Dragoons, of which he was honorary colonel. Once he had distributed photographs of himself wearing their uniform with the Delphic inscription written above his signature, "I bide my time." Today, his time had come. He was supreme in Europe. Say too, except to say, if you haven't read it, I hope you'll get yourself a copy of The Guns of August and plunge in. It's a great read. And to say, from London and from London Walks, good night, stay safe, see you soon, we hope.